Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
And my name is Kathleen McGowan. And I am so excited about our show today. In the 18 months or so that we have been doing this show, we have been so fortunate to have extraordinary guests. We've talked about so many amazing subjects and explored so many topics. But the topic we're going to focus on today, the book, the personality, the author that we have as our guest today, is someone I've been so excited to talk to, because this is a story that if you are not familiar with it, you are going to send us thank you notes. We are going to get so much mail from you guys saying thank you for introducing us to this story, because this is an extraordinary story. You are about to hear a story about eternal love, about eternity, about the eternal nature of the soul. It is a story about ancient Egypt. It's a story about an incredible woman's spirit. It is a story that changed my life 30 years ago when I first came upon it. It is the story of an amazing woman known as Om Seti. Om Seti, I'm going to just give you a little bit of an introduction to her, and then I'm going to introduce you to our author, who is our guest, and she's going to tell you some more. In 1981, I was 18 years old, and I saw a National Geographic documentary, which was rebroadcast from the BBC, about an extraordinary English woman. She was an adventurer, she was an Egyptologist, but her story about how she comes to be these things is the single most extraordinary human experience I have ever had. And so with that introduction, I want to welcome our guest, Catherine Dees, who is the author, the co-author of Om Seti's Egypt. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm just delighted that you fell in love with Om Seti so long ago. I first heard about her around 1980. And thank you, Philip. I'm sorry, we're starting on the romantic part of it so fast. In 1980, I was in Egypt as the historian for an archaeological search for the tomb of Alexander the Great, and it was a psychic archaeology experiment with a number of quite reputable Egyptologists. And our group leader knew about Om Seti, and he took a week off during this project to run up to Abydos, where this amazing elderly English woman was living, and interview her. And I didn't get to go, and I didn't get to meet her because she died soon after that in 1981. But shortly after that, a book came out about her life. And I don't know if you, Kathleen and Philip, would like me to just start speaking about
Absolutely.
Who she was.
Yes, please.
She was born in 1903, and she was an English girl, and her parents were of very modest means. Her father was a tailor, and there was nothing unusual about the family, except that one day when the little girl, whose name was Dorothy, fell down a flight of stairs at the family flat and appeared to die. And the doctor was called for, and he came and examined her, and he declared her dead and went back to his office to prepare the death certificate. The parents, obviously grieving, carried her to the bedroom, laid her out on the bed, and 45 minutes later, when the doctor returned, this little girl, Dorothy, was sitting up in bed eating chocolate and looking very concerned, because she was saying, "I want to go home." And she wasn't talking about where she was. She was talking about some other home that she was seeing that was now part of her memory. And nobody could understand what she was referring to. And she had no reference points at the age of three. She just knew she wasn't home, and home was somewhere else. And it wasn't until a year later, when her family took her on a little outing to the British Museum, that something remarkable happened. And everything was going well until they reached the Egyptian collection. She ran around like a crazy thing, hugging and throwing herself against the statues. And her parents could not pry her little hands away. And she was screaming. And they finally got her out of there. But what she was screaming about was, "I want to stay here. These are my people." And that, of course, disturbed the parents, something awful. And they didn't know what was wrong with their child. So that was the beginning of her feeling that she was a displaced person in life. And for the next several years, she made a habit of playing hooky from school, which was near the museum. And she would just hang out in the Egyptian collection until one day when she was about 10, the famous Dr. Budge, Wallace Budge, who was, I think, the best known Egyptologist in the world at that time, happened to notice her. He had seen her before, and he said, "What are you doing, little girl? Why aren't you in school?" And she said something like, "I don't like school. They don't teach me anything I want to learn." And he was tut-tutting and saying, "Well, what is it you want to learn?" And she yelled, "Hieroglyphs." Well, he found her quite extraordinary. And after a little while of seeing this girl and her seriousness, he took her under his wing and began to teach her hieroglyphs. And obviously the youngest child in his experience to be a serious student of hieroglyphs. And she said later, a few years later, that she wasn't so much learning it as remembering it. And that was the beginning of a childhood intention to get to Egypt somehow by hook or crook. And that she did. But it wasn't until she was in her mid to late 20s that she did. She was able to. And she did it by falling in love with an Egyptian graduate student in London and having a whirlwind courtship and being taken off to Egypt. But before she left, there was another part of the story, and that happened when she was a teenager. And one night she was awakened by a specter in her bedroom, and it looked like a mummy. And it terrified. Well, it didn't terrify her. It alarmed her. And the mummy pulled at her nightgown and tore it. And then it evaporated. And her mother came in and said, "What's happened?" And the little girl knew enough to say, "Oh, nothing. I did it myself." And that was the first time that a person from her past, from that ancient time that she remembered, made itself known to her, and he would appear more and more real as the years went by.
Catherine, I wanted to ask you about this piece of her childhood. I mean, these extraordinary things are happening to her. In the book, you tell some of the stories about how she remembered these temples. She had these extraordinary memories of what this place looks like. How did her family react overall to this?
They were obviously not comfortable with it. And eventually they thought, well, that's just Dorothy. And the family didn't speak of it. But she was definitely an eccentric child in every way. When they moved to the coast, her father bought one of the early movie theaters and put it on little halftime intermission shows, and she would sing. And then she also loved singing some of the old laments of Isis from the ancient texts. And she put on shows with friends where she played the role of Isis going through the death of Osiris, her beloved, and which was the most ancient of the religious ceremonial theaters. She was different, no doubt about it. But the family just put up with her because they loved her, but they couldn't understand her. And she had no one to talk with, really.
And so now we transition to her first trip to Egypt when she is newlywed and on her way to Egypt. What happens next?
On her way to Egypt, she arrives at the port of Port Said. And there is her husband, and she's moderately happy, or not her husband, her fiancé. She's happy enough to see him, but what absolutely overwhelms her is that she's in Egypt at last. And she hardly speaks to him on the way to Cairo as they're being driven there. And all she can think of is, this is Egypt. And these are the things I've seen. And I know this place. She was just, well, the moment she stepped off the ship, she threw herself on the ground and kissed the earth, which, of course, created a stir because her husband, another lovely but conservative man, was quite embarrassed by the scene. And so that was the beginning of a rather shaky marriage where her husband, like her parents, had an awful time understanding her. She was a bit of a gypsy, quite a lot, and certainly no lady in the traditional sense. And she was marrying into an upper-middle-class Egyptian family, which was quite a stretch for someone from her background. She tried to fit in, but she would wander off. She would go to the pyramids. She would go to street fairs and talk to the gypsies. She was doing inappropriate things, but she was just so enchanted with where she finally was. But she knew her destination was Abydos, which was about 400 miles south of Cairo, and that was the place she remembered, the temple, the beautiful gardens, the reflecting ponds. She knew that in her memory. She didn't get there for quite a while, but that was where she was being pulled. Meanwhile, she was trying to deal with a marriage that was just not working out quite as well as it could have, and she was pregnant. And when the baby came, she wanted to name the baby Seti. Seti was the name of the one she knew she loved, but she had only seen that one time as a mummified, ghostly presence. And her married into family was horrified. Nobody names a child Seti. She prevailed and dragged the little child around to her to visit the various archaeological sites. And after a few sessions of this, the family knew that the marriage was not going to hold together, and they divorced amicably. And she promptly took the baby and went to live at the Great Pyramid, near the Great Pyramid, in a very, very humble abode, and sometimes spent the nights in abandoned tombs with a little child. She apprenticed herself to some of the great Egyptologists who were working on the Giza Plateau, and that's where her focus was. Meanwhile, when she was living right near the Sphinx, she began to have visitations in the flesh at night from a fully realized and very handsome Seti, the pharaoh whose reign was around 1300 BC. And she had experiences of being told in kind of a waking dream state a few years before this that she had a past as a priestess, as a young priestess of Isis, and that she had committed a great sin. And for this sin, she had to die. And that was the life before. And where her pharaoh comes in is that the sin was with this man. And he had gotten her pregnant. No one knew except herself, and she would never tell because it was a sin against the gods. What they did, she was wedded to the temple, and she was an Isis priestess, and it was about the greatest sin that could be committed, and the king was no exception in being culpable. When he discovered that she was dead in that life, he could never forgive himself, and so the two of them exited that incarnation with grief and a feeling of terrible guilt and offense against the gods. For that, he wandered looking for her four centuries, which, of course, were timeless, until he did find her that one time in her bed as a teenager. And then after she was married, he started appearing to her. Another thing she couldn't tell her husband.
And we're going to back up on this a little bit, because I really want to emphasize how extraordinary this is. This is not a past life memory. This is a complete experience that she is having at this stage. She is having physical interaction with this man. And I want to really emphasize that, because that's one of the things about this story that is so extraordinary when you read it. And what would you say to those people who are skeptical, to those people who would say, well, you know, this was all in her mind? Because there is some interesting evidence that she was having physical contact with this pharaoh from her past, that
yes.
he was transcending time and space to be with her. And it's almost as if she's living in multiple dimensions during her lifetime.
She is. She is. And she is reasonably comfortable doing it. She carries it off beautifully without anyone knowing for many, many years that she has this extremely psychic and very tangible other life that goes into other dimensions. Her father-in-law once saw the pharaoh as the pharaoh visited while she was married, and knew that there was a pharaoh in her bedroom. And couldn't speak of it again.
Wow.
Because it was shocking. He was seen. He didn't want to be seen. There was something that he was able to do from his level on the other side, which was to draw from her enough vital force that he could materialize. In the ancient language, it was called sekhem. It was not allowed to do it unless the person consented, and she did. She was taken before he appeared to her in that form, in a solid form as a man, as her lover. She was taken to the other levels during sleep, and they met fully on the other side. And at that time, he asked for permission to come closer to her, and she granted it. She was ecstatic that she had found him. And then she was guided back to her room, and she wrote of the experience in great detail. She wrote of being in this mirror existence, this mirror place that they call a menti, where there is the mirror of everything on earth. And there was Seti, and there he was in his palace, and there was his son Ramses II, and others, and she got to know them. Om Seti is not some, and later she was called Om Seti, which means mother of Seti. She was not a foolish woman. She was not jumping into this idea of a past life. She was not talking about herself as if she were Cleopatra or Nefertiti. In fact, she really was very skeptical about a lot of people who would come as visitors and tourists and feel that they had been some great one in the past. But she knew what she knew about herself. And so he began to come. He could only come to her at night, and sometimes the cats would be alarmed and run off when he came. And she kept diaries, very careful diaries, of his visits with quotes. She engaged him in talk about the history of Egypt because she was a scholar in her own way, and he was able to tell her things from his own experience about some of the ancient mysteries, which fascinated her, and she wrote it all down.
I mean, ultimately, she was a great Egyptologist in her own right. And I know that, you know, certainly later in her life, that she was an encyclopedia. She was a walking encyclopedia of ancient Egypt, and people were really astonished by how much information she had.
Yes, and she had a lot of the information because she was a brilliant woman who had studied with some of the greatest Egyptologists of her day, but also because of that something extra, which was her connection with Seti, the pharaoh, who was a very, he had been a great man in his time, a great builder and a great restorer of the honor of ancient Egypt after Akhenaten and after all that chaotic time following his reign. So this man was a man of great honor. And it made sense to me in my own skeptical mind as I was trying to sort this out, as I was working with it, it made sense to me that in his reality and her reality of the ancient time, they would have not been able to be quiet spirits because of what they did, because of what they believed. And so the heaven state or the Amenti state that they found themselves in reflected the state of their spirits and souls at the time they went over in that ancient time. And that's what drew him back so strongly. He had to find her and he had to make amends. For anyone who's skeptical, what can I say? It is what it is. It's a great story, but it could also be a great true story.
But I think actually the strength of Om Sati's is very interestingly demonstrated by the fact that she went to Abydos, she treated that temple complex as her own, and she made some amazing discoveries which really personified or made validation of the fact that what she was living with Seti the First, that it was real, because I will let you tell the story, but basically she made discoveries there which she only could have done if everything was right, if everything yes. what she believed was the truth.
Yes. When she was finally able to get to Abydos, when she found employment there with the Egyptian Antiquities Service, she lived as a 19th dynasty woman. She entered the precincts of this ruined temple, the temple that Seti had built there, which was one of the most beautiful temples in all of ancient Egypt, and was in a state of ruin when she got there. She treated it with the greatest reverence. When she entered the temple precincts, she took her shoes off. She always made her offerings to the chapels of the gods that were in this beautiful place. And she devoted herself to the restoration of this temple. She remembered how it looked. She remembered the beautiful gardens. When she first got there, there was excavation going on to try to find the extent of the precincts of the original temple. And she, in her mind, knew exactly how the whole thing had been laid out, all the grounds. And she told people, she told the Egyptologists who were working there and said, here is where you will find this, that, and the other kind of tree. Here is where the reflection pond was. Here is where we did that. Here's where that was. And nobody believed her at the moment. But as they continued with their excavations, what did they find? Exactly what she said, and exactly the kind of trees she said. The roots were still there deep down. People began to think she knew something, and she did. She was instrumental, almost single-handedly, in making sure that the temple got its funding for restoration. And she was dogged in seeing that it was restored to the way she knew it had been. And it was the way that it was confirmed by the archaeologists who were working on it.
Which is absolutely extraordinary. And also the fact that she knew all of these extremely important Egyptologists, as you say. In your book, there's a very interesting paragraph about how there's more to some of these Egyptologists than sometimes meets the eyes. For example, that Wallace Budge was very much interested in alchemy, that some of these Egyptologists were very much open to entertain her ideas about what was going on. So what was her contribution to Egyptology apart from Abydos? How far does it extend? She lived near the Sphinx, she lived near, obviously, by default, and also the Great Pyramids. What kind of legacy did she leave on Egypt and archaeology beyond the Abydos precinct?
I would say not as much in other places, although her influence was seen in places like Dahshur with the Bent Pyramid, where she did a lot of reconstructive work with the chiseled imagery on those pyramids. She was able to pull together and make sense. She was quite gifted at putting together immense fragments and making them, putting them back as they had been. So I would say that it was a subtle difference that she made, not a world-changing difference. But people came to her, Egyptologists came to her, almost on the QT, some of them, just to pick her brain, to ask her, what do you think about this? And that was, it was almost a behind-the-scenes influence that she had. And she also pressed for some of the, she pressed for an investigation of things that she had been told by SETI. And that, she put ideas in people's heads. For instance, the Hall of Records in Luxor. She spoke of the possibility that there existed still something to be found of the Hall of Records at Luxor, which would have contained records back to the first times of Egypt, very much like what Edgar Cayce was searching for under the Sphinx. And she put these ideas out and suggested future investigations. So I would say that it was more of a subtle influence that she exerted. But her friends in the Egyptology community knew that she knew things. And after a number of years, they began to understand that she knew things because she had a memory.
And I think her story also, you know, we have read about ancient Egypt and how bizarre and wonderfully controversial and intriguing the Egyptian afterlife. If it's the reason why there are movies about ancient Egypt like The Mummy, it's like this thing from the past which somehow can come alive, and Om Seti and everything in her life is kind of like a demonstration of it. So to one side of her life, she demonstrates the fact that what the ancient Egyptians believed is like a truth. But on the other side, and this is kind of like the next question, we have this standoff between archaeology, which paints a certain picture about what ancient Egypt was all about, the very timelines, and then the alternative side of ancient Egypt, which has the old Hall of Records, built the Great Pyramids, all of these questions. Where did Om Seti stand in this debate, and what kind of perspective did she paint on Egyptian history?
Well, you know, I was hoping to find that she was going right with the alternative history people, but she wasn't. She was pretty conservative. I realized after I had gotten to know her awfully well that I had had an expectation that she would be somebody like Joan Grant or Elizabeth H., who wrote the book Initiation, you know, and other esoteric books. I was expecting her to be the complete package with great sort of initiatory understandings, metaphysical depth, and she didn't have a profound spiritual tale to tell. But I complained about that once to a dear friend, and my friend said, but if Om Seti had been a highly advanced spiritual seeker, she probably wouldn't have had the kind of situation with Seti entering her present life in the way he did. She was just a more basic, elemental kind of soul.
And I think that she didn't have a spiritual story to tell because she ultimately had a spiritual story to live.
I think that is so true. We have to remember that in her memory, in this other existence, if it did happen, she was only 14 and 15 when she died. And she was the child of an impoverished foot soldier who had been sent to the temple because he could no longer support her. She was not someone with a great deal of education or even exposure to the deeper mysteries. And in this life, she was intellectually captivated by everything. But I don't think that she went toward the deeply spiritual side.
One of the things that I found really fascinating when I started digging into her Egyptology was her point of view on Nefertiti. And her point of view that she believed that Nefertiti actually left Akhenaten, right?
Yes, yeah. Because she felt very strongly that, first of all, Nefertiti was at least as smart as her husband and really saw the writing on the wall when things started to collapse around him. And she wasn't about to go down with him. And the thought is that because she recanted and went back to the old gods, maybe for the sake of her children, maybe just for the sake of a love of Egypt, that would be why there were so many rumors that she might be in the Valley of the Kings, as some of her other relatives were. Nobody would be buried in the Valley of the Kings who had stayed with the heretical religious beliefs of her husband, of Akhenaten. Yeah, I think that was Om Seti's thought, that Nefertiti was smart, a good political, sharp player, and she converted back. And as a result, deserved an honored place in the Valley of the Kings.
And Om Seti was not a fan of Akhenaten. She felt that he had brought nothing but chaos and trouble to Egypt.
Yes, just a total screw-up. Om Seti respected the gods so deeply, so profoundly. Her lady Isis and Osiris and Nephthys and Horus, all of the god beings, the soul teachers, they were wiped away by Akhenaten just in a stroke when he declared that there was just a single god to be worshipped, and it was the Aten, the disk of the sun. That was unforgivable in Om Seti's eyes, and it was certainly unforgivable in the Pharaoh Seti's eyes, mostly for political reasons. Because Akhenaten had let the empire go to shreds under his brief rule. So the two of them together, Om Seti and Seti, had nothing nice to say about Akhenaten.
Where was Om Seti's son in all of this? How did he deal with it? Did he deal with it? And what ultimately happened to him?
That was a sad, sad story, and another one of those things that it was hard for me to get my head around, and also for Hanny, my co-author, about whom I've said nothing so far. Hanny El-Zaini was Om Seti's great confidant for all the years that she lived in Egypt, and he was the one, he and his wife, who cared for her when she was sick, the one she trusted, the one who recorded hundreds of hours of conversations with her outside, sitting on the steps of the magical Osirion, talking about ancient Egypt. My friend Hanny El-Zaini was the one who inherited all of the secret diaries that Om Seti kept through the years. And he was the one who approached me to partner with him and write this book, which I was so happy to do. My experience is as a writer. I've written many novels, and I could hardly wait to get into this story. But to get back to the child that Om Seti had, when he was about 4 years old, it became quite clear to him, to her rather, and to her ex-husband's family that this child could not be raised in such a haphazard manner, just going from one site to the next, living in tombs. And so she gave him up so that he could have a traditional Egyptian upbringing. And I think she was embarrassed to pay many visits to him. I think she knew that she was not appropriate as a mother. And so he grew up barely knowing her, very few visits. And when she was quite ill at the end of her life, my friend Hanny and his wife reached out to find the son and to bring him to Abydos so that the son could take her away and give her a decent home. She was quite ill, unable to care for herself, Hanny thought. And so they did have a meeting, and it was a poignant and very sad meeting. Because Om Seti refused to go. She said that she would die in Abydos and no place else. And her son was brokenhearted because he wanted to have a relationship with her. And so back he went to his home. And that was it. That was the relationship. And Hanny and his wife were appalled and very saddened by this. It's one of those inexplicable things. But to expect her to be a normal, regular person, I think, is asking too much. She was who she was. And, you know, everyone's life is a mystery, and we can never know it all. But some people's lives are greater mysteries than others, and hers was filled with mystery. She had a number of psychic experiences that are inexplicable. At the beginning of World War II, she was living in Cairo, and one night she woke up from sleep, and her hand was clenched around a small silver amulet of Osiris, the great god. How it got there, she had no idea. She took it to a jeweler, and she had it welded onto a ring, which was in turn welded onto a silver watch chain that she wore around her neck. It was long enough that she could take it on and off. It couldn't be unclasped. She wore it all the way through World War II. There were bombings in Cairo. There was great, great anxiety over the safety of the antiquities. 2 days after the war ended, she woke up from sleep, and the amulet had disappeared. The necklace was on her, around her neck. Everything was soldered. The amulet itself was gone, and she had no idea who had given it to her and who had taken it away. But she knew it had been given to her as a protection. Things like that happened to Om Seti.
We've had a number of shows and discussions here about the near-death experience and how so many people who have profound near-death experiences are entirely changed. Certainly more open, more psychic, more aware. All of these things happen with a near-death experience. Now, she was only 3 when she has hers, but it seems to me clear that she has a near-death experience that is completely transformational. And in some way, this connection with the veil, being in it or being a part of it, is what allows her to have these memories to come back. But I understand that her family later on in England sort of disavowed this. They kind of backtracked on it and said, oh, well, we don't really think she was dead. We think the doctor was wrong. And
he was nearsighted. He couldn't see that she was still breathing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So did anyone in her family ever accept who she was? Did they ever embrace it? Does she have family in England who is proud of this story at all, or was it always
not really? Not really. There was some there was an unusual thing that happened as I was going through the diaries, because Hanny let me have full access to all the tapes and the diaries. And there was one time when she writes of talking with Seti about that moment when she died. And he said that it may not have been that she died, but there is a way of reincarnating where when your spirit is dislocated on the other levels and needs to come back in to make restitution, to finish out some unfinished business, that being, that soul energy, will seek out a body that is quite ill or in a state of coma, or he didn't say coma, but essentially that, and jump in and take that body. So that's another thought, that there was a, that she did leave her body, and that there was a drop-in, if you will, of the young priestess.
And
I don't know.
Is that what she believed?
She didn't. She presented it as just something that he said. So I do not know whether she felt that it was a near-death experience or what. In some ways, she was just so darn practical and accepting of things that you wouldn't dream of accepting, that she didn't seem to ask questions. Other times, she is extremely analytic. It was frustrating sometimes when I really wanted more information and I would be calling Egypt to talk to Hanny. Didn't she ever say anything about this or that? And he said no. So a little bit of unfinished business.
Now, we have so much information about her life because she did keep these journals, and she also entrusted so much of her life and her story to Hanny El-Zeiny. And God bless him for being the friend that he was to her, because he has really been the caretaker of her legacy for such a long time. But was she open about these experiences that she was having with the Pharaoh? Did she ever talk about them to other people? Or was this something she strictly kept confidential?
Toward the end of her life, she had a few friends, women friends, in whom she confided. And they understood. I don't know how many men knew this, but people did start to talk a bit. And then when she was near the end of her life, because of all the work she had done to restore the temple, to bring the whole thing back to such beauty, it became quite a tourist attraction. And people streamed to Abydos. And they knew that she was somebody with special insight into the way things had been. Even Jacqueline Onassis came and was a real fan of hers. I wouldn't say a good friend, but a real fan. And she had arranged actually for the first book to be written about Om Seti, which was written by Jonathan Cott 20 years before ours. And she was the editor. So she had a lot of fans. I don't believe they knew the extent of her knowledge or her belief or her experience with her lover. But she spoke more and more as she aged, as if she had lived these things. And so people assumed that she had some special entree into the way things had been. It wasn't, though, until that first book, which Hanny also collaborated on, that it was revealed the extent of her connection. That first book dealt much more with her psychological state than ours. There's really no need to try to interview psychiatrists to find out how normal or abnormal she was. She just was.
Mm. And this is one of the things, you know, I want to say to you and also ask, writer to writer, I have to say, I just am in awe with what you personally did with this book. This book, Catherine, is so Beautiful. And I loved Jonathan's book, and it was, it had a big impact on me when it came out, but it is a very different book. And what you have done here, and it's written with such beauty, and it's so clear to me that you're such a gifted novelist, because you tell this story and you're speaking and in your writing with such grace and such passion. This is a book that you cannot put it down. You can't wait to turn the next page. It is so beautifully written. And so my final question to you is, we're getting low on time here, and I could talk to you all day.
Darn. And I was going to tell you about the psychic photo, but
oh,
go ahead.
We'll get to it. Let me ask you this question, then we'll
okay.
come back to the psychic photo, because you can't leave us hanging like that. As a writer, did writing this book change you? Did researching her change you? How did it impact you personally and impact your spiritual journey personally?
Well, I got much more deeply into the actual history of ancient Egypt. I had had quite a journey myself beforehand. I had partnered with a lovely woman a few years earlier to create a major museum, well, not museum, a major exhibit that went all over the country for about 12 years, and it was called Continuum, the Immortality Principle. And it was an examination of what we know about life after death and continuing consciousness. And we went back in history. So we had a love affair with Egypt long before this. And then I went to Alexandria to search for Alexander the Great, and that brought me closer, and then I met Hani. So I guess it was fated, and I really felt that Om Seti was looking over my shoulder while I was doing this. I have certain feelings about what seems to be correct spiritually. You know, I was a little bit conservative in some of my thoughts when I started working on this, and I held my judgments until I got into it and I saw this woman is living an authentic experience in two lives. She's honest. Who am I to say this didn't happen? I have no doubt it happened.
And before we move on to something you want to talk about, there's one question. Like, we know Seti I physically manifested in her life when she was relatively young, but Seti lived until a rightfully old age.
She was 77.
What happened in those last 10, 20 years of her life when she was in Abydos? Did Seti come time and time again? The unfinished business, so to speak, of 3,000 years ago, did that resolve itself at some point before? How does the story end?
According to her diaries, they prayed together that by the life that they had led this time together, they had the gods had forgiven them. The one thing that was required was that when she moved from Cairo to Abydos, they could have no more sexual relations. She was once more to be the priestess of Isis, and that was their great sacrifice. And so they felt that by the end they had been forgiven. At least they hoped so. He didn't come in the last several years explaining that to come to her, he needed to take her vital energy, and she didn't have any to spare. And he wouldn't do that to her. She knew he was there, but he couldn't come in that form.
And how do her journals kind of like give details as to how this made her feel to be there and to know he's around, but nevertheless, kind of like, you know, I was you missing him?
Again, the practical Om Seti. It was what it was, and so she accepted it. He promised her that he would be there, and that was it.
All right, now I have to ask about the psychic photograph.
Very quickly, the Seti Temple is a place just laden with energies. And a friend of Om Seti's took a photograph there of a statue of Sekhmet, who is the great lion goddess, very powerful goddess. And when the photograph was developed, there was an ectoplasmic figure like double exposure, only it wasn't a double exposure because this figure was reaching out with a great lion's paw reaching forward toward the person who was standing in front of it. And it was quite something, and I was counting on that to come to put into the book. To me, that was just one of the most amazing things. And when I asked Hanny for a good copy of that photo, he said, oh, I just sold it to a Japanese company that wanted to use it in a magazine. And I was really annoyed. It was such a wonderful photograph. One of the psychic photos that I feel quite confident is true, and that the gods are there with us. We just have to be part of their energy.
Absolutely. And what did Om Sethi believe was going to happen to her? Was she just too practical to speculate or to hope for a next life or this unification with Sethi in the afterlife? Did she ever elaborate on that?
Well, she had visited him in his palace on the other side, and her great prayer was that was exactly where she would be and they'd be together forever. I don't think she had a very sophisticated concept. I say sophisticated as if I'm superior, but I don't think she had a concept of a continuing reincarnation, continuing refinement of the soul. I didn't see that in her writings. I think she wanted to be with the love of eternity. And that was her contentment.
And so here we have Om Sethi, one of the greatest love stories which literally transcend time and space. She died 30 years ago. You have been writing about her since a few years ago. What's the Hanny is old. What's going to happen? What is the future for Om Sethi's works, Om Sethi's memory, so to speak?
He wants to keep it alive. We've talked with film companies at various stages. I don't know what's in his will. I know that his daughter is just as intent as at preserving Om Sethi's papers. So I have no doubt that that everything is safe. But beyond that, I don't know.
Well, we have enjoyed tremendously our journey into ancient and modern Egypt with Om Sethi. Our guest today was Catherine Deese. Her book is Om Sethi's Egypt, the story of ancient mysteries, secret lives, and the lost history of the pharaohs, written by Catherine and her co-author, Hanny Alzaini, who knew Om Sethi for several decades. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Philip. I'm sorry to interrupt, but may I spell Om Sethi for people?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, Omsethy. So the book is Om Sethi's Egypt.
And you also have omsethi.com, is that correct?
Yes, I do. And our publisher has a Facebook page. We'd love to have anybody friend us, and we will keep up with the latest about Om Sethi, and if anybody's interested. And our publisher is St. Lynn's Press, STLYNNSPRESS. I appreciate you allowing me to say that.
Absolutely. And we will put it on our website as well, so you can go to these pages. Our website, for those people who've never been there, is thespiritrevolution.com. We are on BBS Archive, and we are also on iTunes for download, where on iTunes you can now get us for more than a year, roughly 14 months of archive. 14 months at an hour is pretty much 60 to 70 hours of our show available on iTunes. So thank you, Catherine, for being our guest, and until the next time.
The truth against the world.